This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What will our grandchildren experience in the year 2080? Or will some of you feel the heat, climate, and social disruption as soon as 2060? Scientific studies are pouring out their warnings. We have already passed the danger levels, and there is no sign of action to stop horrible climate change. What if the politicians fail to reduce greenhouse gas emissions enough to keep the Earth's climate from warming? What if the people of the world keep on pumping out carbon dioxide as they do now? Can we survive? Will the Earth head runaway climate change morphing to another Venus? The widely accepted danger line is 2 degrees Celsius, that's 3.4 degrees Fahrenheit, global mean temperature rise over pre-industrial levels. Land surface temperatures will heat up much more than that, and even more in the Arctic. We have already warmed at least 0.7 degrees Celsius, and we're seeing big changes now. Counting the masking effect of other pollution, the warming in the pipeline may already be around the 2-degree level, and the major polluters show no signs of agreeing to the steep cuts at the Copenhagen Climate Treaty talks in December 2009. So what will happen? In this program, we're going to cover major new scientific reports about our climate situation. Then, almost as a relief, we'll go to an interview with one of the longtime activists with solutions from the UK, Dr. Jeremy Leggett. He's an oil expert who crossed over to Greenpeace before becoming a solar energy entrepreneur. I also have some new climate music for you. Right now, we'll get hot and heavy with an international climate conference held at Oxford in Britain from September 28th to the 30th. The title is 4 Degrees and Beyond. We'll hear the results of some of the first scientific studies of a failed climate world. The conference opened with one of the top climate advisors in the world. Professor John Schellenhuber is from the Potsdam Institute for the Climate Impact Research. He is a past director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Research in Britain. The German version of his name is Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber. He has directly advised many heads of government, including Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany and even Barack Obama. The title of his talk, Terra Quasi Incognita, Beyond the 2-degree Line. This was a presentation to fellow scientists, so part of it is heavy going for the rest of us. It was also accompanied by slides, and I'll give you the web address for those a little later. So in order to hit some of the key points from this speech and several others from the 4-degree conference, covering several hours of audio, I'm going to attempt a digest of this latest science for you. Professor Schellenhuber explains that the 2-degree target was set in 1995 as the upper limit to avoid species extinction and other dangerous impacts. The 2-degree target was just adopted at the recent G8 meeting. Schellenhuber thinks a worldwide adoption of the 2-degree target is the best we can hope for in Copenhagen because, quote, nobody should dream of the possibility that there will be numbers reduction measure for each country in the world, which will be sealed in Copenhagen this year. That's almost impossible, end quote. 2 degrees is also the target set by the European Union. It's a compromise. Of course we can lose the coral reefs, he says, but we will save the Greenland ice sheet if 2 degrees over pre-industrial levels can be retained. More recent work, published in the PNAS, that's the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science in the United States, this year by J.B. Smith and others, including Bill Hare, shows that even the 2-degree limit may not be safe for us. A meeting of 2,000 scientists in Copenhagen last May issued another report, which called for a peak in global emissions by 2015. Schellenhuber says we are lucky that the physics of Earth, which is usually nonlinear and discontinuous and very complicated, has provided us a simple yardstick to measure climate change, the amount of carbon dioxide released to the atmosphere. We can measure that easily and perhaps control it.
A Nature cover story, the coming climate crunch, that was, I think, in April, 23rd of April or something, where two groups, in particular Malte Meinshausen from Potsdam together with colleagues and Miles Allen here from Oxford, came up more or less with a similar approach, the budget approach. And it means more or less between the year 2000 and the year 2050, humanity is allowed to release about 1,000 gigatons of CO2 into the atmosphere, to the first order of our physics, climate physics. Unfortunately, we have eaten up already 300 in the first 10 years, so we are left with 700, 750 or something. If we want to have at least a 75% chance of holding the 2 degrees line, which is, by the way, not a brilliant chance. So if you would do that in a calculation of a nuclear power plant, so probably people would feel very uncomfortable if we would sit next to a plant where a 25% chance of getting it blown up would exist, but it's only about the planet we are talking about, so it's no problem.
How fast we get off oil and coal and how much time is left to preserve the remaining forests while controlling agricultural emissions, it all depends on when we start the cuts. The later we wait, the more wrenching the change will be.
If we would immediately peak next year, because of Copenhagen, with global emissions, when we would have to do every year a 2% reduction of emissions. That sounds very feasible. But now the vicious integral strikes. Integrals can be very vicious, as you may know, and this is one of the instances. If you wait another 5 years, when this amounts already to 3.6% reductions in a linear world here. But if you wait till 2020, which is much more likely, when you will have to reduce every year by 6%. And that is seems already unfeasible. And then you go on and on. But if you wait a little bit longer, you actually end up, starting with the year 2040, with negative emissions. That is, you have to extract carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which may be done. I had a nice chat with Klaus Lackner from the Earth Institute at Columbia last week. But it can be done in principle, but it cannot be done in practice. That's the problem.
So if we wait until 2040 to start reducing greenhouse gas emissions, that total carbon budget will already have been spent. Nothing left for the rest of the century. Then we cannot emit carbon at all. We must start reducing it by some unknown technology. So we can't wait until 2040. The German Advisory Council worked out a fair way of distributing our remaining carbon budget, aiming at 2/3 chance of staying under 2 degrees. That's not a great chance, just 2/3 of a chance of staying relatively safe. They settled on a per capita allowance among all people of the world, balancing it out a little better each year, but disregarding our historical responsibility in the West for past emissions. The United States, which starts out emitting 20 tons of CO2 for each and every person every year, would have to stop emitting CO2 altogether by 2020. Germany, which has a lower per capita rate now, would have to stop by 2030. China would have to peak by 2020 and phase out by 2035. This report was presented at a meeting with the Obama administration, but it was felt that the Senate would never agree to ending fossil fuels in the U.S. by 2020. Note that a Zero Emissions America by 2020 is the project promoted by Al Gore. It exactly matches the science of what we need to protect the world climate. One solution is to allow countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan, where people produce and use very few emissions relative to their population, to allow these less developed countries to sell their carbon credits to wealthier nations. The result would be the largest north-to-south transfer of wealth in the history of the world, a reverse from the days of empires of Europe and North America. The physics of Earth doesn't care who burns it, just the total emissions reaching the sky. Research shows that if we double CO2 in the atmosphere, which is possible, the result in the long run, perhaps hundreds of years later, will be a 50-meter sea level rise. That's 193 feet. Enough to drown our coastal cities. Shellen Huber says, quote, "So even at 2 degrees, this is something which will sink most of our coastlines," end quote. Another scary result of climate disruption is the creation of dead zones in the ocean.
In particular, it means if we have unbridled climatic change, what we will see in the end is not so much sort of the carbon pump in the ocean will be suppressed, but there will be something like oxygen holes in the productive layer between 200 and 800 meters deep, which is very important for production of fish and so on, because there will be a complete depletion of oxygen, which is a new finding. You see it here, for example, in the Indian Ocean. that would be one of the not much discussed yet effects of global warming, unbridled global warming. Oxygen holes, like the ozone holes you have in the stratosphere.
We'll hear more about the possibility of a deoxygenated ocean leading to a possible mass extinction event when I interview Dr. Peter Ward about his new book, The Media Hypothesis. That's coming up soon on Radio EcoShock. We are digesting a speech by Professor John Schellenhuber at the 4 Degrees and Beyond Climate Conference at Oxford, UK, September 28th. Another recent scientific paper shows that even if we stop greenhouse gas emissions today, totally, the climate will already warm to 2.4 degrees above pre-industrial levels with severe climate impacts. So we are committed now. Scientists don't know whether the glaciers in the Himalayas will completely melt away from what we have already put in the sky. They are melting fast now. If we go beyond 2 degrees, Schellenhuber notes, those glaciers would go at some point, and they provide the summer river water for all the major rivers of Asia, used by over 1 billion people. Also interesting, some have called the Himalayan glaciers the third pole of the Earth, matching the Arctic and the Antarctic. The weight of the glaciers have geophysical implications. We don't know what will happen to the surface of the Earth if that weight is removed from this relatively new mountain system built from a collision of continents. The tipping point of the Greenland ice sheet, which is already thinning fast, as we find from very new scientific evidence coming from the satellites, that's also not known. But the giant in the room, the biggest tipping point, is the carbon trapped in the Siberian and northern Canadian permafrost. If that is released, says Schellenhuber, we are toast.
There is the really big giant in the game, that is the permafrost reservoirs of methane and other things. So the newest estimate is that over 1.5 trillion tons of carbon is stored there. And that's twofold the amount in the atmosphere, by the way. So if this is ever released, then we will be toast, of course.
Scientists have been investigating how these various tipping points might interact. For example, if the Greenland ice sheet melts, it will release a lot of fresh water. How will that impact the ocean thermohaline circulation system, including the Gulf Stream, that keeps Europe warm? Ocean circulation could also impact the summer monsoon in Asia, the water that feeds billions, although flooding millions. No research has yet been done on these large-scale interactions of tipping points. Dr. Schellenhuber and many others will be releasing a series of papers this December called the PNAS Special Feature on Tipping Elements. One of the presentations will be on dust as a tipping point. It turns out the largest source of dust in the world is the Bodele Depression in the African Saharan country of Chad. It used to be the bottom of Lake Chad, which doesn't exist anymore. Half the dust required to fertilize the Amazon rainforest comes from the Bodele Depression, spelled B-O-D-E-L-E. All the models agree that the Amazon rainforest will die back due to climate change, and we'll hear more about that later in this program. Other tipping points in the upcoming paper this December include the frozen methane on the ocean beds called clathrates and the impact of climate disruption on the El Niño Southern Oscillation in the Pacific, those heating of ocean waters that shape so much of our weather. There is good news and bad news about the clathrates, the methane ice balls down on the ocean floor. The good news is scientists think clathrate melting and the release of the climate-heating methane gas will be slow over centuries or even thousands of years. The bad news is it will be unstoppable once it starts. Let's hear Dr. Schellenhuber say it.
We have David Archer, who did together with his colleagues the first ever model study on the methane clathrates in the oceans, how they would be mobilized. So I'm not talking about the permafrost, I'm talking about the additional sources on the ocean shelves. And he came to the conclusion, together with his colleagues, that there will be a very slow release when the planet warms of the methane from these clathrates over 1,000 years maybe. He calls it an extremely slow tipping point. The problem is once it gets started, it's irreversible. And it would add another huge amount of carbon or methane to the atmosphere.
That study on clath rates coming out next December is by David Archer, our guest on the September 18, 2009 Radio EcoShock show. His new book is The Long Thaw. Download our interview with Dr. David Archer as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org. What about the worst of the worst, runaway greenhouse effect? The temperature increases until the oceans evaporate. Earth becomes like Venus. Is it possible? Hans Joachim Schellenhuber thinks not.
Let me conclude speaking about the unspeakable, that is runaway greenhouse effect. And Anders Lebermann and I have done a fairly simple calculation. Now, what are the forces which we have to consider? The first one is the black body radiation, which goes to the fourth power of global mean temperature, which is, in a sense, equilibrizing everything we are doing. So this is the derivative of that is this line here. So if you change by 1 degree the global mean temperature, then, of course, this radiation goes up, and it's a negative feedback, if you like. That's very important. But there are positive feedbacks, and this is calculated here. If you add 1 degree warming, for example, you have water vapor, positive feedback, but you also release from permafrost, for example, carbon, you change the albedo of the planet, vegetation dieback, and so on. So, in a sense, this was an attempt to say, here we have the negative feedback, let's measure the same metric, so to speak, the positive feedbacks, and then, of course, you have human intervention and human interference as a, not a feedback, but a force, which is actually shifting us along the temperature line, whether the feedbacks exist or not. And this is the conceptual approach. The question is there something like a runaway greenhouse effect? It's called the Venus effect. You would reach a certain point when a system starts to amplify its warming by itself. So you're just like pushing something over the ridge, and then by gravitation it gets accelerated and accelerated. We don't think there is such a thing on this planet. It never happened in history. The other thing happened, namely snowball Earth, So a runaway glaciation actually happened twice, probably. But we have not seen, probably we have no evidence for a runaway greenhouse effect. But there can be something like a limited runaway greenhouse effect, where you enter a temperature T1, and when the system by itself pushes temperature to another level here, and this could be a jump in temperature of centuries, whatever, by 5 degrees or something. And we cannot exclude that yet. So if you do the calculations, so the IPCC has, of course, looked at the feedbacks here, right, and has calculated, well, the distance to something like a runaway greenhouse effect, that means the positive feedbacks would have to add up to reach that line here, is just something like 1 watt per square meter, which is not much, actually, because you have to add human interference, clearly. The calculation which has to be done, you have to look at all the missing feedbacks. So it's oceanic CO2 uptake, it's albedo from Greenland, melting. Greenland is, again, the black horse in the race. It's probably the Achilles heel of this planet. You have thawing of permafrost and so on. You have something, I recall, I have given a lecture in this very room, actually, 10 years ago, Richard Betts has reminded me of that with Jim Lovelock. It was about Gaia hypothesis and so on at that time. So the DMS, you know, the cooling by sort of a Gaia, negative Gaia feedback by producing the right organic material to produce clouds and so on and cool the planet, was en vogue and has been heavily discussed. Actually, it is a feedback, a negative feedback, more or less one of the very few we can think of. Whether it's strong enough is a completely different thing. I don't think so. You see, most of the colors are red, so they add up. So it may be that if we go beyond the 2 degrees line, say 3 degrees, some of these things may add up to overcome and to overthrow the Stefan Boltzmann law, namely the black body radiation, and then the system will move by itself to a higher temperature. But we will enter ever something like a Venus process that would mean that all the oceans would have to evaporate and so on. I don't think it will ever happen. Unfortunately, we have never calculated this, and it can't be done with the state-of-the-art GCMs, of course. So we are thinking in Potsdam about doing first conceptual models about it, writing down the right nonlinear equations, and just to open up this field.
Black body radiation, what is he talking about? It's a physics term and a little complicated. For our purposes, when considering a warming planet, we know that the molecules and atoms of our physical reality vibrate differently when they are heated more. For purposes of measurement, the amount of radiation is compared to a standard, namely an ideal black body, which emits nothing. Everything emits black body radiation, even you. This is the scientific basis of the so-called greenhouse effect. The math formulas to calculate Earth's black body radiation are complex, but the main variable is temperature. I'm not a scientist, so if I have described this incorrectly, please write me with the correction. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. Schellenhuber says black body radiation is a negative feedback, meaning it actually helps to cool the planet. That cooling is overwhelmed by other positive feedbacks. Remember, positive doesn't mean good. It means a force which adds to an existing trend, such as global warming or increased precipitation. The positive feedbacks include more water vapor and possible releases from permafrost and so on. Schellenhuber doubts there will be a runaway climate change, the so-called Venus effect, because there is no evidence it has happened in the past. However, we could have a limited self-reinforcing warming, which would be disastrous for most species, including us. As it turns out, no one has been able to calculate whether a runaway greenhouse effect could happen. We just don't know. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. That concludes our summary of the opening speech at the 4 Degree and Beyond International Climate Conference held at Oxford, UK on September 28th. It was delivered by Professor John Schellenhuber from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. The title was Terra Quasi Incognita, Beyond the 2-Degree Line. You can download the whole speech and others from that conference from www.eci.ox.ac.uk/4degrees. www.eci.ox.ac.uk/4degrees, or get that rather complicated link from the Radio EcoShock show blog posted October 8, 2009. You can get our blog right from our main page at ecoshock.org. Let's take a quick break with a clip from Don't Kill a Watt by Seattle band Million Dollar Nile.
All of the CO2 we're jamming, now the coal-fired cannon, and all the rivers we're slamming and slamming, we're damming. It's a calamity, all the energy for humanity. Or we'll be cramming and scamming so we can leave a ramming on the dark side of the planet. Damn it, the bats don't need the light, but we're leaving it on all night. Raccoons don't need your iTunes. Come on and make it Mac off tonight.
Tonight.
Don't kill a Watt, I say. Why you kill a Watt? Turn it off.
No brown out, no black out.
Don't kill a Watt, they say. Why you kill a Watt? Turn it off.
Broadcast on 16 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. It's radioactive. Are fossil fuels half gone? Can solar energy really work? Our guest has the answers. From Britain, we have Jeremy Leggett, an oil man who became a green campaigner and then a solar front runner. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Well, as a young geologist, you had research funding from British Petroleum and Shell, and then you tossed the prospects of a very well-paid career to advise Greenpeace instead. Why did you leave the oil industry?
Well, it was at a time when concern was growing among atmospheric scientists that we were heating up the atmosphere because of the known heat-trapping ability of the greenhouse gases. And that was something that I suppose had just never occurred to me. I think culturally, you grow up in things that where there are cultures that avoid risk, and that's still going on today in the oil industry. But I'd done research on the history of the oceans. I knew a little bit about the climate system, as it were, from the bottom up, and what can happen over geological periods of time. And I became very quickly worried about climate change, and sadly, what's happened in the subsequent couple of decades has done little more than fan that concern.
Well, when I first heard about you in the mid-1990s, you were going to oil industry conventions warning that carbon damage to the atmosphere made further exploration pointless. And at the time, the idea of leaving fossil fuels in the ground seemed scandalous, almost mad. Do you still say that?
I think, and the difference is, of course, I'm not as... There are many people now saying that kind of thing, and particularly about coal, and coal is the real problem. I do think that we face some issues with now, with the speed at which we can feasibly retreat from oil, and we don't want to risk wrecking our economies and leaving ourselves in a situation where we can't deploy the survival technologies that we know we must turn to eventually. Renewable energy and energy efficiency. So the real issue is coal. There's a lot more of it than there is of gas and oil. And of course, we daren't burn some of the more plentiful unconventional oil and gas deposits like the Athabasca tar sands that can be turned into oil and the methane hydrates, which can release vast quantities of methane into the atmosphere. But we do need to maximize the use of conventional oil and protract as long as we can the time when we can rely on that substance while, you know, engaging in a very rapid retreat towards energy efficiency and renewables. And these are technologies that are not called renewable for nothing. They are not finite in the way that oil, gas, and coal are.
Well, I wish we had time to go into your insider look of the international climate negotiations, but we'll let listeners get that from your book, The Carbon War, Global Warming, and the End of the Oil Era, published by Penguin. Instead, let's fast forward to 2005 when you put out a new book on peak oil. Can you tell us about Half Gone?
Half Gone was an effort to try and popularize this peak oil argument, which is still a minority concern of people. And there's a lot of whistleblowing going on in and around the oil industry, but it often tends to be by folk who, you know, are writing for their peers, who don't try and summarize things in ways that are easily understood by lay people. That's what I wanted to do with Half Gone. I tried to make it a book that will be comprehensible by people who don't have a scientific background. And there's no primary research in it. There's plenty of primary research by others, including now, of course, the International Energy Agency. But my effort was to popularize the subject, and I've continued that work with a UK industry task force. There are now a number of companies in British industry who are concerned about the peak oil issue. We have a task force that's done one report and working on a second.
And there's that never-ending debate about whether peak oil could help save us from catastrophic climate change. What have you learned about this interrelationship since that book came out?
I think the jury is very much out. The good news is, of course, that the renewable energy markets are now some of the fastest growing markets in the world, and the economic stimulus packages on both sides of the Atlantic are pushing people more towards energy efficiency than might have been the case otherwise. But equally, there are many people who are retrenching into carbon. So Shell, for example, is going all out for the tar sands in Canada, and coal to liquids. Liquid hydrocarbons can be produced from coal, albeit with many greenhouse gas emissions. So it's not clear who's going to win this battle of ideas, but it's very clear from my perspective who has to win it.
Well, Shell and BP have been talking green for some time. I mean, they even call themselves Beyond Petroleum, but they've been doing very, very little. I was really disappointed when Shell backed out of that giant wind farm proposed offshore to help power about a quarter of London, they said. So they raise these big hopes, and then they go back to the dirty carbon every time. Do you think that's really going to change?
Now, I don't. I was optimistic for a while. I think BP played a major role in getting people to take climate change seriously. They were the first major carbon company to split from the what was a universal lobby around the time of the Kyoto Convention in 1997. But they have retrenched, gone back into carbon now, and I think it's even worse in a way because, for example, the other day the chief executive of BP said that in his opinion, solar photovoltaics would never be economic, would never be competitive with fossil fuel electricity unless there was a technological breakthrough. Now, this is a bit like the famous quote from the leader at IBM who said he thought there'd never be a market for computers or maybe just a market for a couple of computers. Because the analysts in the investment banks are saying, you know, that in their opinion, solar electricity is going to be as expensive or as cheap, the same price, as conventional energy, electricity rather, in most industrialized markets within just a few years of now, and already is at the same price in some markets where the electricity price is higher than normal.
We're speaking with Jeremy Leggett, author, scientist, and energy professional in Great Britain. And he isn't just writing about global problems. He's now launched part of the solution. Jeremy is executive chairman of his own solar energy company called Solar Century and a third world empowerment group called Solar Aid. Can we start with Solar Aid? What is that?
Well, it's a charity that we set up with the first profits from Solar Century, feeling that, companies... progressive companies should play a role in trying to stimulate development and tackling some of the problems in the developing world. We made our first profits in 2006, and we gave 5% of those to Solar Aid. It was only a sum of about £35,000 at the time, but the small team that we were able to create with that has leveraged funding from foundations, other companies, that's now measured in the millions of dollars, and we're very proud of what it's doing. It's active in four countries in Central Africa and really is training young entrepreneurs to make and sell ways of generating light at night with solar, so solar lanterns and other pieces of equipment. And, you know, it's a candle for hope, like Solar Century itself. And it helps me a lot with Solar Century because, you know, many of the young people at the company, although it's a fully commercial, venture capital-backed, Silicon Valley-backed solar company, it's trying to conduct itself in a different way. And this is very important to the young people who work there.
Well, I think that solar power in a place, perhaps in Africa, can make a huge difference to things like education. If you've got light at night, it can
sure.
reduce the pollution of other options. And you don't need these big central companies with massive investments. You can start small and just keep building. It sounds like a good plan.
Well, even organizations like the World Bank, who for so long have clung on to the old model of centralized power plants and grids, they've backed off that now, and they're on record as saying, really, this is the only answer for the developing world. We can argue about, you know, companies that already got grids, but if you don't have a grid and you've got hundreds of millions of people to develop, to bring them to light at night, as you say, the education connection is so important with health and welfare and all the rest of it. Yeah, it's great work to be doing.
Well, I looked up a couple of YouTube videos on your commercial company, Solar Century, and one thing that surprised me is you're pushing solar panels in Britain, a country known for cloudy skies. Is solar power really workable in such northern countries?
Yeah, sure. The fastest growing market in the world is Germany, and they have the same kind of insulation that we do here in the UK. It surprises many people to know that if you do the calculation for solar cells of existing efficiency on available roof space from, you know, land registry statistics in cloudy Britain, if we put solar panels on every available roof space, we generate more electricity than this cloudy and electricity profligate country currently consumes. And that shows the potential. Now, would you want to do that? No, that'd be a crazy thing to do when you have so many other ways of generating renewable energy. Solar isn't a magic bullet. It's just one member of the family. But it does show the potential, and I think, you know, it's even better for people in sunny parts of the world, but it does fine for us.
Can you tell us about a couple of interesting solar applications you've been involved in? It might give us some hope here in North America.
Well, we're specializing in Solar Century. We've chosen to specialize in building integrated solar, photovoltaic electricity and solar thermal. So we make roof tiles and slates and bespoke parts of the building envelope. Now, there are American companies, very fine American companies, who do exactly the same. But right or wrong, that's what we've chosen to focus on here in Europe. We're active in four countries. And it's just a part of the market, and fast growing as the solar PV market is, the building integrated solar photovoltaic market really hasn't taken off yet. So we're hopeful of being able to, you know, be in the front rank of companies that innovate ahead of this wave of innovation that's coming. Right now, most of the growth of solar PV is on ground-mounted systems or simple systems that are attached to large roofs rather than actually forming the frame of the buildings. And we think as time goes by, that emphasis is going to switch more into the building itself, so that buildings become power plants capable of providing their own electricity and their own heating. And as other companies innovate in energy storage technologies, I think the energy company, the energy utility of the future is going to look a very different animal from the one that we have at the moment.
Well, I'd hope so. I'd like to pick your brain about the recent economic crash and the prospects for alternative energy. As you know, as we all know, the governments in the UK and Europe and here in North America have just handed errant bankers trillions of dollars, more than the cost possibly of converting the world to renewable power.
Yeah.
And now they say, well, we're too broke to help green energy.
Yep.
Some solar and wind projects have been canceled. Is there hope we can convert to green energy even in these tough economic times?
Yeah, you know, hope lives very definitely. If you look at the rate of recovery now in this upturn, whether it's temporary or not, of course, we can debate about that, but the recovery of the renewables technologies is faster than other things. And this is because of two main drivers. If you talk to the analysts, it's about the enduring driver of climate change. More and more people are worried about climate change. Companies as well, in the heart of the establishment, there are real concerns, and therefore that driver stays in place. But also energy security. More and more people are coming to the view, because of peak oil or just the politics of having to import gas and oil from insecure parts of the world, that they're turning more and more to renewables and efficiency. So I do think hope lives, but boy, it shouldn't be this difficult. It really shouldn't.
Well, you mentioned the major companies. There was a collection of companies here in North America, including GE, who publicly backed carbon regulation in the United States. But we've just learned through an industry email released by Greenpeace USA that these same companies, through the American Petroleum Institute, are plotting to derail upcoming climate legislation. They're going to bus people in for meetings, and they're going to get all their sub-energy companies organized against it. Well, and it's pretty hard to take their public pronouncements seriously when we find out they're fighting it through the back door still.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of greenwash about, and it doesn't help. I think there are people who are pretending to go through with some of these measures. But equally, now, if you look at the way it's ingrained into the culture of many companies, it's gone beyond greenwash. In the retail sector here in Europe, for example, you see that the supermarket companies competing with each other with fairly meaningful and deep emissions cuts programs. And that's something new. You know, I've been in this business trying to argue for action on climate change now for more than 20 years, and I've seen real and pervasive greenwash right across the corporate sector. But now there's important stuff going on, and some of these companies react as much to their own staff as they do to customers. So I think that's something to be hopeful about, not to be overstated, and we have to be really vigilant about the continuing dinosaurs like Exxon and you know, companies who you have to conclude that culturally are never going to change. They're going to go down all guns blazing. But, you know, others are changing a lot, and I think we have to fan those fires of change if we're to have a hope of turning some of these disastrous problems around.
Yeah, I'm hoping we don't go down with them. Well, one good sign, Americans drove 100 billion fewer miles last year, I'm told, and the economic downturn has reduced energy use and maybe even CO2 emissions. I'm wondering, would a lasting economic slump stall peak oil, or could it mitigate the climate crisis and give us a little time to work out other alternatives?
No, I don't have any hope on that front. I think that, you know, the downturn is something that can still involve an awful lot of fossil fuel consumption, because don't forget, you know, the real growth of disastrous emissions now is in India and China. That's where the fastest growth is. And you're going to have to watch those economies collapse to have any sort of hope that emissions are going to change. And even then, I'm not sure they would. The answer, I think, is that we have to accelerate these already very fast growth rates in renewables and efficiency so that they reach tipping points and then take off at the speed of epidemics. And then people see what's coming. They see what the future is, and they want to be in on it. They want to have industries, homegrown industries, that are making hay with these survival technologies. And I think that's where hope is. And we did a little book with the breathtakingly original title of The Solar Century, just published, that tries to articulate a vision of how that could happen. And these are very disruptive technologies. They can invade traditional carbon energy markets very fast. And I think that's what we have to hope is going to happen and angle to have happen. And I think, you know, I'm a cautious optimist. I think that we have more than a fighting chance of doing this.
Last year, I listened to American climate campaigner Bill McKibben speaking to industry leaders in Indiana. This sort of ties into what you're talking about, I think, because 95% of the electricity in that state is generated by dirty coal plants. And I found myself thinking, maybe places like that will have to be abandoned as climate change becomes so visible and so deadly we can't deny it anymore, and locations with renewable energy will become the most prosperous. We'll have to adapt to whatever we've installed. Am I just dreaming there, or would you agree?
Well, I think there will be winners and losers. You know, it'll be like the Toyota. There'll be the Toyotas of the energy sector, and there'll be the General Motors of the general sector of the energy sector. But the great thing about renewables is that they're very diverse, and they can work in all sorts of different environments. So I wouldn't subscribe to the view that because, say, Arizona is really sunny and they're going to get it about solar earlier than other people, and all the solar technology and industry is going to be down there in Arizona, therefore, and poor old Indiana is just going to be left with defunct coal. I think, you know, you're going to be able to see renewables industries spring up in many states in America. And many of these technologies make most sense if you use them, you know, right where they're manufactured. And, of course, here in Europe, countries like Portugal and Spain are saying to developers, you know what, if you want to come and build wind farms here, come build the factories as well. Then we'll give you a license. If you give us jobs for our people locally, you can have a license to come here and make hay with renewables. And I think we'll see more and more of that as time goes by.
As we wrap up, can you give us a website to find out more and anything else you might like to add?
I have a website where I regularly download my own reading and thinking about these issues. It's got the very original title of Jeremy Leggett, all one word, leggett.net. And I really hope that's useful for people. I maintain it with the hope that it'll be useful.
Jeremy Leggett is a geologist, author of several books, and a campaigner on peak oil, climate change, and better solutions. He's a columnist for Sublime Magazine, blogs at the Guardian newspaper, and appears on CNN. Leggett founded Solar Century and Solar Aid. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith. Hey, America, where do you get your good grease? Well, it's time for a little dirty energy news from Canada, your largest supplier. Not Mexico or Venezuela or even Saudi Arabia. Good old Canada. Maybe not for long, though. There's a worldwide rush to grab a hunk of the world's biggest and dirtiest industrial project, the Canadian tar sands. According to a Globe and Mail article September 1st by Nathan Vanderkleep, quote, Canada-based Athabasca Oil Sands Corp. on Monday sold a 60% interest in two of its undeveloped projects near Fort McMurray to the international unit of PetroChina Company Limited. The transaction will hand approximately 3 billion barrels of Alberta oil to PetroChina, whose parent is the state-owned China National Petroleum Corp. End quote. And Dick Cheney thought he was going to get it all. Just imagine a reawakened Canadian nationalism one day and it tries to shut down the tar sands to, oh, I don't know, save the Arctic climate. Well, good luck. Now, it's an international incident. Not that the Yankees would have invaded for their share of the gookie stuff if we tried to turn off the tap. Might as well make it an international party. The French monster company Total SA is planning a 90,000-barrel-a-day expansion to its project at Surmont, co-owned by ConocoPhillips. That would boost Surmont's production to 250,000 barrels a day. It takes one barrel of fossil fuel to produce just 3 barrels of oil. Currently, there is no price for carbon here. Just dump it all in the Canadian atmosphere for free. Canadians will just have to install a few more low-energy light bulbs, I guess, to soak up this storm of industrial CO2 pollution from the tar sands. The CEO of Total E&P Canada, Jean-Michel Geer, says his company pays $40 a ton for carbon, but wait, the oil-friendly Canadian government never collects it. No legislation at all. A wild west for climate pollution. The headline should read, France joins China in a gang rape of the Canadian landscape. Greenpeace broke into 3 oil sands plants in the last 3 weeks. Jean-Michel of Total agrees they have some image polishing to do. As they ramp up to high production for 2025, the year most Western countries need to be totally fossil-free to protect the 2-degree global warming ceiling. They're talking about tar sands production in 2035 and investing in that after rising seas and storms will have triggered mass migrations and city devastation. Is this really a good investment, folks? Dump Total SA stock and don't buy their climate-killing gas.
Get out!
Another energy giant, TransAlta, runs coal-fired power plants in Canada and the United States. But they want to add a nice green shine, so TransAlta took their fossil fuel profits and purchased a greener company called Canadian Hydro Developers. Now TransAlta has more hydro and wind power in its stable, taking the company from 15% renewables to 22%. TransAlta CEO Steve Snyder, we name names at Radio EcoShock, say their deep coal pockets will keep greener projects funded even in difficult times. Or will they shut down some renewables later, saying it doesn't pay? The jury is out. And meanwhile, TransAlta remains a major force for climate pollution. Contrast all this coal and oil sands action with a new study from the Tyndall Center in Britain. These scientists have the nerve to suggest that people in rich countries, quote, must slash living standards to fight climate change. This anti-consumerist treason is actually printed in newspapers over in Europe, in this case by The Times in London on October 2, 2009. Ben Webster, The Times environmental editor, gives us the scoop. I'll quote the article here. Living standards in Britain and other rich countries must fall sharply over the next decade if the world is to avoid catastrophic global warming, according to a leading climate research center. Consumption of energy-intensive goods and services should be cut and remain capped until low-carbon alternatives are available, said the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research. The study says that Britain's carbon dioxide emissions need to fall twice as fast as planned by the government. It concludes that global greenhouse gas emissions are rising much faster than previously thought. It says that Britain should commit to making all energy, including for electricity, heating, and cars, zero carbon by 2025, at least 25 years earlier than planned. The center, a partnership of seven universities including Oxford, Cambridge, and Manchester, says that the economies of developed nations will have to shrink and consumption of almost all types of goods will have to fall in the short to medium term. Speaking to The Times, Professor Kevin Anderson, the center's director, said, quote, "The wealthier parts of the world, including Britain, will have to seriously consider reducing their levels of consumption over the next 10 to 15 years while we put in place low-carbon technologies. That may mean having only one car per household, a smaller fridge, buying fewer clothes and electronic goods, and curtailing the number of weekend breaks that we have. It's a very uncomfortable message, but we need a planned economic recession. Economic growth is currently incompatible with reductions in absolute emissions," so says Professor Kevin Anderson of the Tyndall Center in Britain. That study says that global emissions are rising much faster than has been assumed by Britain and other countries in setting their carbon targets, it says in the Times Online. These targets are dangerously misleading because they focus on distant dates, such as 2050, and avoid mentioning the immediate cuts that are needed. Professor Anderson calculates that emissions in all developed countries must peak by 2012 and fall by 20% a year from 2018 to prevent global temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees above the pre-industrial average. Well, that was from the Times Online. Thank you for that. The current recession, which is actually stage one for the bigger depression, in my opinion, is already starting to cut some emissions in a few wealthy countries. Americans drove a billion miles less last year and bought less crap at the malls. As a result, by one report, overall CO2 emissions may have dropped by 9% last year from 2007 levels. That's an astounding result. If President Obama had demanded a 9% cut, there would have been death panels and teabaggers galore. Now the recession has awakened at least a few people to simpler living. There is already talk among a small cadre of scientists and political advisors that the recession should be prolonged if possible while we convert away from fossil fuels. Even a false recession might help prevent the Arctic ice fields and the Himalayas from melting. Give nature a break. Ugly as that sounds, it may be our only way out. Another scientific study, published in the journal Science on September 11th, says we don't have the tools to mount any response to a number of intersecting crises. It's titled Looming Global Scale Failures and Missing Institutions. Basically, the authors studied energy, food, water shortages, a declining ocean, emerging diseases, and, of course, climate disruption. They found that our system of national governments could not cope with these global issues, often choosing their own self-interest over global commons. Many other governments are simply unable to act, whether in Africa or the United States. The authors found no international institutions strong enough to deal with these issues either. The science is in. Humans can't cope and will likely just slide from one disaster into another. We all knew that, but it's nice to see it made official. There's mildly good news and terrible news on the Arctic ice front. Recall, we need the polar ice caps to provide ocean and atmospheric circulation. All agriculture and our civilization depends on those cold zones. The good news, the National Snow and Ice Data Center has released new figures showing older ice forming over the Arctic Ocean. After the 2007 meltdown, there was concern that a single year's ice layer would melt away quickly. But now we can find some ice that is 2 years old, meaning the Arctic ice might hold on a little longer. Nobody disputes it will disappear in the summer in the next decade or two, but the longer it stalls, the better for all of us. The really bad news comes from the British Arctic Survey in a news release September 23, 2009. Satellite lasers show that land-based ice fields in the Arctic and the Antarctic are thinning quickly. Quoting from their press release, reporting this week in the journal Nature, researchers from the British Antarctic Survey and the University of Bristol describe how analysis of millions of NASA satellite measurements from both of these vast ice sheets shows that the most profound ice loss is a result of glaciers speeding up where they flow into the sea. The authors conclude that this dynamic thinning of glaciers now reaches all latitudes in Greenland, has intensified on key Antarctic coastlines, is penetrating far into the ice sheet's interior, and is spreading as ice shelves thin by ocean-driven melt. Ice shelf collapse has triggered particularly strong thinning that has endured for decades, end quote from that press release. As we said, the results have been published in the journal Nature. Google around and find those new maps of both the Arctic and the Antarctic ice loss. The loss is visible and ugly. Some glaciers have doubled their speed towards the sea. Greenland has lost an incredible amount of ice. It's thinning out, and nobody knows when or if it will simply crack and fail. With the melting now confirmed already, estimates of sea level rise this century will go straight up.
Citizens of the nation, I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country.
Thank heavens New Yorkers finally found out about it. They were oblivious to a city report saying rising seas would flood the subways and cripple the city. Well, that's no wonder, as the New York Post is an adamant climate change denier. They run every fake anti-climate story they can find. Well, at least that used to be the case. 100,000 copies of a special edition of the New York Post appeared just recently. The fake paper was jammed full of climate information New Yorkers had been denied, and it was all factual. Greenpeace and the Yes Men are rumored to have floated the real news for New Yorkers. The giant tabloid headline simply read, "We're screwed." That's about it for Radio EcoShock this week. Visit our pitiful website anytime at ecoshock.org. You can even sign up for our podcast there. Check out our Radio EcoShock blog for some links for this week's program. Next week, we'll brighten it up a bit with a mass extinction expert, Dr. Peter Ward. He says Mother Nature is actually a wild killer. Thanks for hanging in there. I'm Alex Smith.
He studies what's happened in the past. And he says the chances are so-and-so of that happening again. So he predicts. This is very useful to be able to predict, because that has survival value. But at the same time, it creates anxiety.
We'll go out with a little radio from Elvis Costello.
In the years ahead, China will further integrate our actions on climate change.
We did not come here to celebrate progress today.
Shining the light, and I dialed doing anything my radio advised. With every one of those late night stations playing songs, bringing tears to my eyes. I was seriously thinking about hiding the receiver when the switch broke, cause it's old. They're saying things that I can hardly believe. They really think we're getting out of control. Radio is a sound salvation. Radio is cleaning up the nation.
Philip. teens right now. You can't link it to climate change.
We're now convinced we could see a global warming of 4 degrees well before the end of the century, in 2070s, possibly 2060s.